If everything's ready here on the dark side of the moon, play the five tones. Yes, that's right. Welcome back, dear viewers and listeners, to the newest episode of Silver Screen Cinema Classics, where we're always keeping an eye out for strange phenomena. I'm your usual host, Mike Wilson, and we've gone from one extreme to the other with our guests. If you're a regular listener, then you'll know that in our last episode, it was left to just me and Sandy to hold the fort and break down North by Northwest. But this time around, we have an embarrassment of riches all drawn to this podcast tower for our review of Spielberg's wondrous sci-fi Close Encounters of the Third Kind. First up, we've missed him while he's been gone, but he's back and ready to jump back into action. It's my right-hand man and co-host, DK. Welcome back.
Hello.
You ready to talk about Close Encounters?
Always, mate. I had to come back for this one.
Nice. And looking forward to talking about it, because I know that you were a big fan and it's a first time viewing for me, so we're coming at it from two different places.
Nice.
And we're joined by two guests as well for this one. First of all, a Trek podcast guest and I believe Silver Screen newcomer, Justin. Welcome.
Yeah, hello.
Yes, I was saying newcomer, you would have been on Silver Screen when I put like a cut down version of the Star Trek Nemesis review you were on, but chances are very few people would have watched that, and quite rightly so.
For what it's worth, I had fun with that, even, you know, it wasn't the most exciting, best, you know, topic for a movie, but, you know, I still had fun. We made it work, I think.
It was watchable, I guess. Hopefully we'll all think better of this one, but we'll see, I suppose. And we're also joined by all-round Renaissance man and regular Silver Screen guest, Michael Whaley. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, everybody. Glad to be back.
Glad to have you back. And can't wait for your particular input on this one. So, yeah, we'll begin breaking down Roy Neary's Alien Contact soon. But first, we do have a ritual here on our Silver Screen spin-offs. It's also partly a bet between myself and DK. So, Justin and Michael Whaley, you've never been on Cinema Classics before, so I'm going to ask you one by one for your personal number one cinema classic film. And by that, I mean any film released from the dawn of cinema to 1979. And Justin, I'm going to come to you first for that one.
So, what movie I think is, like, the peak of cinema from that era?
Well, just your favorite. I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily well-renowned, but your favorite personally. Yeah.
I would have to say Rear Window.
Wow, okay. That was unexpected. Okay.
We haven't talked about it because it's a sci-fi podcast, but I've been on the Star Trek sci-fi podcast, but when I was a teen, I was a huge old Hollywood for all of my school days. I always thought the other kids were weird that they couldn't appreciate the beauty of Grace Kelly.
Wow. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. It's one of my favorite Hitchcocks as well, that one, but I didn't even know you were that into that kind of classic cinema.
I was probably the only kid in my second grade class who saw the original King Kong and then went to go see the remake in 2005. And then when they said, oh, hey, the director of this also did those Lord of the Rings movies, I was like, oh, good for him.
Fair enough. Well, you've cost me that bet because I had bet you were going to go with something sci-fi. So we'll see if Whaley can save me. Michael, what was your favorite cinema classic film then?
Well, I'm neurodivergent as hell, so it's always difficult to... I can, hey, what's your top five? I could probably do that. But because this movie, it not only is classic and is amazing, but it also has a special place in my heart for that, I'm going to go Blazing Saddles.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Harumph! Well,
I'm zero for two on that one.
What did you think? What did you think I was going with?
Well, we have a list of things that people have already picked, and I was like, I've got a feeling Whaley will pick something that's on the list, because we have, Alien and Godfather were the two that I was like, I've got a feeling you might go for one of those two. And
they're great movies. They're not in my top five.
What did you have me pinned for? I have to ask now, Mike.
I was sure you were just gonna pick Star Wars.
I love Star Wars. Yeah, don't get me wrong, but I actually don't have as much of, I would say, as emotional connection to it as I would say like Star Trek or something.
You're always posting on social media about Star Wars.
because it's fun. Because I think I don't feel as emotionally invested in it that like I don't take it as personally if my post
you won't get
flops.
Your feelings hurt. You won't get your feelings hurt if somebody says something mean about it.
I'd never have had you pinned for going for a Hitchcock movie. And we do have some on the list as well. I think we have North by Northwest on I know we've got Psycho on the list, but not Rear Window.
One of these, I should have turned my camera on because behind me on my shelf is a box that says Alfred Hitchcock, the Masterpiece Collection. I got it as a Christmas gift when I was 12.
Oh, wow. That is awesome. That's respect. Well, hopefully we'll be seeing some more of you on the Classics or the Silver Screen podcast. Then it sounds like you've got your, you know your stuff.
I'm more or less available.
Fair enough. Awesome. Well, yeah, with that out of the way, then it was only a quick little thing. And like I say, I've lost. So congratulations, DK. I think that's at least one more point to you now.
Yeah. I still don't know what we're betting for, but yeah, I'll take it.
Just bragging value. That's literally it.
What will you give me? Respect.
Respect, yeah.
rather have an item, but okay.
Anyway, with that out of the way, I'll move on to reviewing the movie in question, which this week is going to be the 1977 film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Before I dive fully into it, I will say that, yes, I'm aware there are three versions of this movie, and I have a very quick breakdown of them, and then I'll explain which version that we're going to actually be analysing today. So first of all, there is the theatrical version, which is 135 minutes, or 2 hours and a quarter, if you do the maths. And then a special edition was released theatrically in 1980. Spielberg agreed to create that edition to add more scenes that he'd been unable to include in the original release, and with the studio demanding a controversial scene depicting the interior of the mothership so that they could have something to hang the marketing campaign on. Spielberg is directly quoted as saying, "I never should have shown the inside of the mothership." He added 7 minutes of new and previously discarded footage, but he also deleted or shortened various existing scenes by 10 minutes. So the runtime is actually 132 minutes, which is 3 minutes shorter, as you can probably work out, than the original release. The special edition features several new character development scenes, the discovery of the SS Cotopaxi in the Gobi Desert, and, of course, that view of the inside of the mothership. Spielberg's dissatisfaction with the altered ending led to a third version, the director's cut, on VHS and Laserdisc in 1998, later released on DVD and Blu-ray. It's the longest version at 137 minutes, and is primarily a re-edit combining Spielberg's favorite elements from both previous editions, but obviously removing the scenes inside the mothership. So, yeah. The film was later remastered in 4K and was re-released in theaters in 2017 for its 40th anniversary. And although the 1980 Special Edition was the only version available for many years, all Blu-ray and 4K releases now contain all three versions. And because this is Cinema Classics, we will be reviewing the original theatrical 1977 release. And because I hadn't seen this film before, I know, shocker, that was the only one that I've seen and the one that I watched. So that's what I'll be reviewing because I figured, you know, start at the beginning. I can always watch the other versions later, although I'll probably avoid the one that Spielberg supposedly hates. So, yeah. Everybody okay with this? With that?
It's been years since I had watched it, and the one that I found for on Prime was the director. It was Spielberg's cut. The one with
the kind of final director's
little bit extra, but I didn't see the inside of the ship, which I didn't remember ever seeing that. So I don't know that I've ever seen those the other cuts of the movie. So I've seen the original. Yeah. And I think this director's cut are the only two that I've ever seen.
That's fair enough. Yeah, the special edition would be the other one in the middle, which is the only one that shows the inside of the mothership. But
yeah,
like Spielberg actively sort of saying, "Please don't watch that. I shouldn't have shown that." Means I probably won't ever watch that version. But we'll see. I suppose.
Maybe we'll just read it like showed what? I don't know. If that one doesn't exist.
Exactly. Yeah. Although I am intrigued by some of the other additional scenes, but if they're on the other version anyway, then fair enough. But, with that then out of the way again, we'll move to our behind the scenes section, and I've split up the workload this week. So DK, rather than giving you everything, even though it's often your purview, I've given you the first half of the behind the scenes. So are you ready with that for us?
I have, yeah.
Go for it.
Okay, the film's inspiration arose in Steven Spielberg's childhood when he and his father watched a meteor shower in New Jersey. At age 18, Spielberg completed the full-length science fiction film Firelight. Many scenes from Firelight were incorporated in Close Encounters on a shot-for-shot basis. In 1970, he wrote the short story Experiences about a lover's lane in a Midwestern farming community and The Light Show, a group of teenagers seeing the night sky. In late 1973, after completing work on the Sugarland Express, Spielberg developed a deal with Columbia Pictures for his science fiction film. 20th Century Fox had previously turned down the offer, renowned for good business decisions even back then. Spielberg first considered doing a documentary or low-budget feature film about people who believed in UFOs. He decided a film that depended on state-of-the-art technology couldn't be made for $2.5 million, borrowing a phrase from the ending of The Thing from Another World. He retitled the film Watch the Skies. Spielberg started work on Jaws in 1974, delaying Watch the Skies, but with the financial and critical success of Jaws, Spielberg was able to negotiate a high degree of creative control from Columbia, including the right to make the film any way he wanted. Now, at one point, the main character was a police officer, but Spielberg found it hard to identify with men in uniform. I wanted to have Mr. Everyday Regular Fella, he was quoted as saying. Hal Barwood and Matthew Robbins, friends of Spielberg, suggested the plot device of a kidnapped child. Spielberg then began to write the script. The song, When You Wish Upon a Star from Pinocchio, influenced Spielberg's writing style. I hung my story on the mood the song created, the way it affected me personally. During pre-production, the title was changed to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is derived from ufologist J. Allen Hynek's classification of close encounters with extraterrestrials, in which the third kind denotes human observations of extraterrestrials or animate beings. The full list of classifications is featured on the film's poster, where the first kind is defined as sighting a UFO, the second as physical evidence, and the third kind as contact. That's all.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. I'll carry on from there. So yeah, Hynek, who you mentioned, worked with the United States Air Force on Project Blue Book and was hired as a scientific consultant. Project Blue Book, if you're curious, was the code name for the systematic study of unidentified flying objects, or UFOs, by the U.S. Air Force from March 1952 to its termination on December 17, 1969. Hynek said that, quote, even though the film is fiction, it's based for the most part on the known facts of the UFO mystery, and it certainly catches the flavor of the phenomenon. Spielberg was under enormous pressure to make another blockbuster after Jaws, but he decided to make a UFO film. He put his career on the line. So yeah, USAF and NASA declined to cooperate on the film. NASA reportedly sent a 20-page letter to Spielberg telling him that releasing the film was dangerous. In an interview, Spielberg said, I really found my faith when I heard that the government was opposed to the film. If NASA took the time to write me a 20-page letter, then I knew there must be something happening. Well, and in his original 1973 pitch to Columbia, Spielberg claimed production would cost $2.7 million, although he revealed to producer Julia Phillips that he knew the budget would have to be much higher. The final budget came to $19.4 million, just a little bit over. Columbia studio executive John Veitch remembered, if we knew it was going to cost that much, we wouldn't have greenlighted it because we didn't have the money. Columbia were able to raise $7 million towards that from three sources, Time Inc., EMI, and German tax shelters. And that's all the information I have about that. So we'll say no more about that one. So, yeah, anything in there that you guys didn't know or that sparked the imagination a little bit?
I'd say purely from a business / financial approach, I feel like Spielberg definitely picked up a few tips and tricks from his friend George Lucas.
Yeah. Just really lowball the studio. Yeah. Yeah, we can do it for 2.7 million, sure. And then it goes to 19. But
respect, I didn't know about the letter from NASA.
Yeah, no, I didn't. And when I read that, I was like, that is really intriguing that they were like, no, it's dangerous to reveal this. And like I said, the fact that it was the guy from Project Blue Book that was the consultant. So it's the guy who knew all about the UFO phenomenon and, you know, might know other things that we don't, who knows.
But yeah, I do like that he's got a cameo in the movie.
Does he? Oh, where's that?
Towards the end, where the ship opens up, a fella comes forward. He's got like a white beard. He looks a bit Colonel Sanders-like.
Oh, I didn't know that. And that's Hynek, is it?
Yeah, it is. Awesome. So he's got a cameo alongside, was it Carl Weathers?
Yeah, Carl Weathers is the military policeman. I noticed that straight away. Yeah. Yeah, and the other cameo, of course, being the Starship Enterprise and a Klingon D7 battlecruiser when he, when Roy's ripping everything down to make the tower sculpture. I was pretty pleased.
I like how Lance Henriksen has a cameo, but he's listed as one of the main actors. That's a really
weird didn't spot thing. Him, I'll be honest. I saw him on the cast list, but it went by me. Yeah. Well, fair enough. So, yeah, we're going to jump into the discussing the various sort of things that we always do. We break it down into like writing, directing, VFX, you know, various things that we'll come to and you'll see. I'm sure you're aware if you've listened to the podcast before. But again, if the conversation flows any particular way, we'll just follow it. We don't tend to stay rigid. So we'll start with the writing. I only have one tiny bit of information to share, which is that it was a very messy writing process, and though Spielberg received sole credit for the script, he was assisted by, deep breath, Paul Schrader, John Hill, David Giler, Hal Barwood, Matthew Robbins, and Jerry Belson, all of whom contributed to the screenplay in varying degrees. So, yeah, it was a bit of a weird one, and I won't detail the entire sort of process that it went through, but if you go, you know, looking around Wikipedia or online, you can find the various drafts and the ideas that didn't end up happening. And I will note that there was an idea, this is probably quite famous, and I don't have full information about this, I didn't write it down, but there was an idea to make a sequel to Close Encounters called Night Skies, which eventually stalled, but became two other projects. It became ultimately Poltergeist and E.T. So you can almost kind of see the lineage there in that way, because they were going to make it a bit scarier. And yeah, so that's where that went up. The scary part became Poltergeist, and the kind of befriending one of the aliens who likes humanity became E.T.
When I was
pretty
watching
fascinating.
I 100% was so, like, I need to do an alien horror film for myself. Like, I need to write one and do one. And so after this has made me want to go ahead and do that, because I've done other horror, but I haven't done anything alien related. So I kind of want to do that now after watching this.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I mean, like I said, this is the first time I watched it, and that I was struck by when the aliens abduct Barry. That scene in the house when, is it Julia or whatever, I can't remember the woman's name, when she's like running around screaming like, go away, and they're trying to unscrew the vent and coming down the chimney and stuff. I was like, I can definitely see how this inspired Poltergeist. This basically is that movie. I look at all the toys coming to life and the vacuum cleaner operating by itself and stuff. I was like, yeah, I can see where that comes from. So, yeah. Right, so did you guys have any thoughts whatsoever on the writing that you wanted to start us with before I jump into kind of themes and things like that?
I mean, for me personally, I love how it perfectly like toes that line between being like a sort of like slow burn exploration, like thought piece, but also having like a very linear story to it of like a character want and like a character arc to it, you know, something like that, where I think it's a very, I can't really think of another movie that kind of does, like most sci-fi movies are either more 2001 or more Star Wars, if that makes sense. And this, mm-hmm. I think, actually kind of toes that line very nicely. If that makes, like, you get what I'm saying, right?
No, yeah. I do, yeah. And I was, yeah, it's actually something that I picked up on, like I said, because I know of the film, and I've seen, as is often the case with kind of classic films, I've seen clips and I've seen, you know, oh, this is one of the greatest shots in sort of cinema history or great moment or whatever. And I knew the vague beats of the movie. But when I came to watch it, I just assumed, because all of the research that I had was mostly about the ending, I was like, oh, well, I would imagine it's going to be a slow burn and it'll be like 90 minutes to an hour to 2 hours, sorry, of like build up before you get to the big finale moment, and I'll strap in ready for it to be quite slow. And then like when the truck sort of gets abducted 20 minutes in and the first alien spaceship goes flying overhead 25 minutes in, I was like, this is not what I expected at all. This is just, we're already hitting the ground running a lot quicker than I thought we would be. So I was pleasantly surprised about that. Is that what you meant, the kind of the pacing and everything? It's not quite as, like I said, 2001, I would argue, is perhaps a bit slow. And Star Wars is obviously full-on action all the time, and it's a nice kind of middle ground to that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because, and also, it has that pure, like, Spielberg, which, I don't know if I'm maybe I'm jumping, but, like, there's that line towards the end of, like, ordinary people and extraordinary circumstances, which is almost kind of like the entire ethos of Spielberg's, like, filmography and his, you know, career, which, you know, I just think is like, and of course, like the way that the alien, you know, thing, you know, the whole, the alien thing, I don't know, but you know what I mean? Like the alien presence, like disrupts Roy's family dynamic, which that's a huge recurring theme in a lot of Spielberg's movies. So I'm just like, it's pure Spielberg for me.
Yeah,
and probably everyone else.
I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, what about you then, Michael Willie? Is there something that you particularly like or dislike about the writing, and what kind of hit you the first time you saw it? You know, that you can remember.
Yeah, that's to say, like, it's been years and years and years since I'd seen it. I remember enjoying it. It's Spielberg. It's usually, not much that he can do wrong. The writing, like, as Justin was saying, I do like how it does toe the line a little between there. It's like, I hadn't seen it in so long, and so there was a lot of things that I didn't remember. There was major imagery, and, you know, the mashed potatoes at the dinner table was always a thing, because that's always gets put into other cinema as a joke here and there for parody movies and things. I didn't remember as much of it, so the it did hit me well. Like, it does toe that line really good between being, you know, a lot more action than you thought, not as slow. Because I did kind of remember feeling that it was slow a little in spots, but I didn't this time. So, but yeah, it had been a long time since I had seen it, but it definitely, I definitely do think it is, you know, all Spielberg.
Oh yeah, and I mean, I'm a sucker for Spielberg, so having grown up with kind of Spielberg movies and being a lot older now, I mean, if I was younger, I might have found bits of it a bit slower, but I can't say I did this time. I thought the pacing was basically perfect on it. The only slight nitpick I would say is that I could have lived with seeing more of the, and again, I'm terrible with names, the French UFO investigator played by Francois Truffaut. I might have liked to see a little bit more of him and that kind of investigation rather than all Roy, basically, but
Claude
that's
Lacombe.
A real nitpick. Lacombe, that's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Claude Lacombe.
Thank you. And Lacombe and his assistant played by Bob Balaban, whose name I also forgot since yesterday.
David Laughlin.
There we go.
So, I've got IMDb pulled up. I am not memorized. Do not have that memorized.
Oh, thank God. Yeah, I thought I was just really bad.
But I have a confession. When I first did watch this movie, I thought Bob Balaban was Richard Dreyfuss because he looks so much the way Richard Dreyfuss did Jaws.
I did exactly the same thing because he starts the film and I was like, oh, that's Richard Dreyfuss with the Jaws beard. And then when Dreyfuss appeared clean shaven, I was like, so who was the other guy?
I did the exact same thing. Yep. I 100% was like, wait a minute. Wait, that wasn't Dreyfuss in the beginning, was it? Because I was like, I don't remember Dreyfuss being out in this thing when I saw it way back in the day.
And if you want a really random piece of nerdy, grown-worthy trivia, both of Phoebe from Friends' parents are in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, I did.
Bob Balaban and Terry Garr.
I thought you meant like Lisa Kudrow's real life parents. I was like,
no,
what?
The character from Friends, because they both appeared on the show as her dad
I did
and her mom.
Assume the same thing, Justin. So it's okay. I was like, oh, that's cool. I didn't know. And then you said that, I was like, wait, her mom's Terry Garr?
No, she plays her mom on Friends.
Which I've seen Friends, so I shouldn't know what you were talking about. But I thought, oh, like, I didn't know Lisa Kudrow was a nepo baby.
No, that's that was just my little geeky spot for anybody who's a Friends fan. You'll appreciate that one. But so DK, what about you? I mean, I know obviously from the communication that we've had that you knew and loved this film. It's not really a spoiler to say that. So what was it that drew you in and that you can remember? And is there any part of the writing that you particularly respond to?
I love how it carries the mystery. As you say, the first abduction isn't until about 20 minutes in. But that first 20 minutes, to me, it's almost like a masterclass in how to build up the tension. So that when it does finally arrive, there's almost you almost get an outburst yourself, simply because when it starts off, you're in the New Mexico desert, obviously, with the planes. And then it cuts immediately to that really tense air traffic control scene. And it's just a bunch of people sitting around talking, but it's done so well. And then, you know, obviously it cuts to the, do you want to report this? No, we don't want to report it because nobody wants to be made a fool of.
And, yeah, I wouldn't know what to report, etc.
Exactly. And then it cuts to the engineers, the lights going out, and you know something's coming because it's obviously Spielberg, and you can kind of sense where it's going. But it's not until that when he waves that first guy back and calls him a jackass for standing in the middle of the road, and then the lights come up behind, and it misfuts you because you're expecting the same kind of thing again. So when the lights raise, you know, that's when you're going, aha, it's here. And I think that first 20 minutes is just, to me, it's just chef's kiss. And I think that's why I like this Spielberg film more than any, more than a lot of his others. It's, I think the writing on this is really, really good because it puts you ill at ease. And I don't get that with a lot of other Spielberg things. I mean, even Jaws, which is an out-and-out horror movie. To me, you know, it's there. It's supposed to be scary. But the tone on this one, you're not quite sure where it's going, especially when you've watched it, you know, when you watch it the first time, and especially if you watch it when you're young, you're not sure whereabouts it's going. And I love that uneasiness, and I still get that uneasiness when I watch it. And I think it's not only it's a directing choice, but I think the writing on this is just really, really well done.
Yeah, I agree. It's mixing the writing and directing, but what the heck, it's kind of related. But I felt the same thing. Never. I actually made the note. Yeah, exactly. I actually made the note that there's the perfect sense of just a little bit sort of weird, just a little bit disquieting. Not too bad, as you say, not horror, but just the right kind of weirdness as they kind of you know, traipsing around at night and seeing those people holding up the signs about be friendly and the ships flying past. And I was like, this is just the right kind of, even just the right kind of dreamlike almost, and the right kind of not quite, you know, not quite fully grounded or whatever. And I love that kind of tone. And again, that's kind of, it's very typical Spielberg. To refer back to my notes here, it's actually something Spielberg, or at least one of his scholars, has referred to as youth spiritual leaning. Because obviously, you know, it evokes kind of a childlike wonder in us, which again is very Spielbergian anyway. But you also have, again, a Spielberg staple. You have a kid in this, and he does refer to the UFOs and their various kind of ships as toys, although apparently that isn't that's not part of the script. It was because they were using toys off stage to get the actor to react, and so he was reacting to actual toys. But it kind of just makes sense anyway, because again, it serves as the motif for the kind of innocence. And you know, he's not scared, he's innocent, he's open, he's just full of wonder at what this could be. And yeah, I love all that.
As you say, it never feels grounded to the point where it's gritty. It almost feels like, I would say, an adult fairy tale. And I think that's kind of what Spielberg's going for. And I like the fact that, it's intertwined with that When You Wish Upon a Star, because, it kind of interplays. And I love that little, that kind of vibe that's throughout.
Yeah, and I think that's also, you know, as you said, Wish Upon a Star, the way that Spielberg says it was about the feeling that gave him, but also the way that it combines with music and sound becomes vital, you know. So again, that's, to me, that's sort of something that's more ethereal than you can fully analyze. You know, you can be robotic in playing music, but you've got to have a little bit of feeling and a little bit of soul there. And I think this film kind of taps into something with that.
Yeah,
as I said, I'll just repeat this thing that I've written down because I thought it was quite fascinating. There was an interview with Spielberg on Inside the Actors Studio. Host James Lipton suggested that Close Encounters might have another more personal theme for Spielberg, and is quoted as saying, "Your father was a computer engineer, your mother was a concert pianist, and when the spaceship lands, they make music together on the computer," suggesting that Roy boarding the spaceship represents Spielberg's wish to be reunited with his parents, which Spielberg has said he wasn't consciously aware of, but certainly, you know, he can see that aspect. And yeah, I think that's beautiful. And I can see that. I can see why that might be the case. And especially if you're going to, you know, it's about childhood yearning, and that would make a lot of sense. Yeah. Does that make sense to everyone else?
Of course, yeah. I'm not sure if you have this in your eyes, but something I remember reading is that, you know, Spielberg made this movie before he had kids. And he said if he had made this movie after he had kids, he wouldn't have had Roy get on the ship.
Yep, I had that exact note. Thank you. Yeah, that was in 2005 he said that, and I'm kind of glad he did, because I honestly, that was one of the issues that I had, very small issues with this film, but that was one of the ones I had. It was just like, yeah, I'm not comfortable with that. So I'm kind of glad Spielberg's come out and said he wouldn't have him do that now.
I did watch this with the family last night, and when he's getting on board at the end, my dad says, "All right, then, mate, just get on."
Well, as I was saying too, like he had already cheated on his wife with the other lady.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, oh, he's done with his family completely. Between kissing that other woman and then getting on the ship, I was like, oh, he's done. He's leaving.
Yeah. And Terry Garvin. I was like, Terry Garvin's a buzzkill anyway, right? No, sorry.
Oh, that wasn't fair. She didn't know what was going on.
Yeah,
no,
I know. I know.
She's still
trying to track him down for the alimony.
Oh my God. Exactly.
Didn't even occur to me, but yeah, that's going to be an awkward one,
like,
isn't it?
She wasn't being an adult, like, is really what it comes down to. And there's just some people who aren't, but yeah, it was...
Oh, I would argue she's being too adult. She's not really looking at things with any kind of wonder. Oh, not, she's just kind of like, oh,
not
whatever.
That part of it. It's her actual reaction, like the, some of the yelling and stuff. She went from zero to 60 real fast.
I can understand that. She's got like three kids to take
care of. Yeah, but it was early on too, before he was going full nuts. Like it was just like,
yeah.
Like he was like, hey, I'm having trouble. And then she's like, no. And then freaks out.
Oh, I disagree. I didn't see that at all. And yeah, I thought she was actually... I kind of saw that when she said to him, you know, when he drags her out of bed to go to the middle of the highway without saying why. No, and she's really kind and even says, like, don't you think I'm taking this well? Like,
oh, no, yeah, exactly. It was then. It was right before he had the big psychotic break. It was before that. Like, she wasn't even that angry once he did break. She was like, nah, we're just leaving. It was just, there was something that I just thought was a little much at one point. It was after, like, he was in the shower. That scene. Yeah, it was just, that's not how adults should react to this, but...
I don't know, I think we're going to disagree on that. I think it was the best...
I mean, she was also yelling at the children, she was yelling, I mean, it was just a bunch of, like...
Well, yeah, the children, because the children were trying to copy his crap with it, like, oh, Dad, when we're done, can we go and throw dirt in my window? I'm like, jeez. And then...
It was before that part.
Oh, fair enough, but yeah, no, I think she was... I'm on Jerry Garr's side, and I did actually...
I'm on 90% Terry Garr's side. There was just a small part to me that I was just like,
But no, I messaged DK when I was watching the movie because he was asking, like, what do you think? Let me know when you're finished. And I was like, I really wish that Roy hadn't kissed Julia or whatever, the Gwyla woman. It just reeks of, like, oh, I'm going to leave my wife because this woman understands me because we've shared something. And I'm like, I would have been much more preferred if it was like, yeah, we've shared a bond, but it doesn't have to be romantic. We don't have to go the obvious route. And like you said, it's kind of like you've cheated on your wife and then you've abandoned your wife and kids. It's like, oof.
Well, I agree. And I was already first thing I said when he kissed her, I was like, I guess I'm cheating on my wife, is what I said when I was rewatching it just now, but or earlier today. But the one thing that I will say, though, is, and I know why they did it in my head, in the writing, it's shared, not just bonding, it's shared trauma. And shared trauma has a weird effect on people sometimes. At the same time, my just logical brain was just like, oh, he's just cheating on his wife now. I think from a writing perspective.
I think it was worse for me because, again, I've said to DK, I didn't really like Roy in the movie anyway. He's not, he doesn't come across particularly likable, like with his insanity and his kind of obsession. And I know that's one of the themes, you know, all the nature of obsession and Spielberg, you know, I wanted to deal with everyday individual whose life is torn into upheaval. And I'm like, but you don't have to show him being just a dick to his, you know, his wife and kids. And like, I get it. You know, you're doing this thing. And yes, you know, within the narrative, it's because you've got this implanted image you need to deal with and whatever, but geez, talk to people. You know what I mean? There's nothing stopping you just sitting down and talking like an adult instead of starting to throw things around. And I'm like, this guy is such a jerk. I'm really with his wife. I would have driven off as well.
I do like where he wakes up at the table and his daughter's watching the cartoons. And the first thing she says is, are you going to yell at me now?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the very on-the-nose Marvin the Martian cartoon you saw.
Yeah.
Funny, not to be like armchair psychiatrist almost, but I feel like, especially in those scenes where the family, like Roy and his family, are complete and utter like dysfunction, I feel like that is pure like Spielberg bringing his own like upbringing and family dynamics into the movie and that sort of thing. Like that scene where Roy is in the shower and the family is just like in complete chaos. For me, that is almost like, just from what I know about Spielberg and his own childhood upbringing, like that could have almost been like a copy paste of his own, childhood experiences.
Oh yeah, for sure. And there's some realism to it. I'm not saying it's unrealistic. I know families, including my own, who act like that sometimes. But as the kind of adult of the family, I think it's kind of his responsibility, like I said, to sit his wife down and be like, "Look, something crazy is happening. I have this image. I need to deal with it." And like I said, just don't go ripping things up and throwing dirt through the window and stuff, and then expect her not to care.
The worst part of that to me was the ducks. That poor neighbor. I would have been, if my neighbor came over and started doing that right there, I'd have been already been fighting that neighbor. Like,
well, she tried, and then she was like, oh, just take it. I'm so, because she was so scared because he was off his walker.
Yeah, no, he's nuts.
It's times like these I'm so grateful I live in a neighborhood where every neighbor just pretty much just buries their nose in the sand and just buries their head and just like short from like the house the neighbor's house being on fire, it's like you do what's right for you. You know,
I guarantee you though, yeah. There's some of your neighbors just like, here, like, I don't like drama, but I don't mind seeing other people's drama through a window. Yeah. I 100% am that person that would be outside vacuuming my driveway, like just to see what's going on in the neighbors. Like, I am that type of person. So,
I own up to that as well. I feel you.
Yeah. So that your neighbors are just all like you. If they do it, they just aren't talking about it outside.
Yeah. And whereas I would entirely be that woman sticking the head out with the hairdryer on the go, just like, what's going on?
No, if I do see one of my neighbors suddenly start like ripping up the garden and throwing the plants into the house, I'm like, okay, what? Like, I'm gonna be like peering through the window, like, what's going on?
Here's the thing: I have a line though that if I saw something enough, if I need to go out and help something, I'm gonna go out and help something. Like, if I'm like, oh, this person has lost their mind, they're destroying neighbor's property, let's go out and see if I can talk to them and try to calm them down or move them away and distract them long enough until some sort of help can get there for them. Like, there's a line that I would have with that. And I would have already called the police and been out there trying to see what was wrong with him if I was one of his neighbors. But that is also contemporary time and not in the 70s. So,
yeah, I wasn't there, so I don't know how I would have responded.
Yeah, and I get that, like I said, it's obviously because of the, you know, the triggering of this image from having contact. But at the same time, Jillian doesn't act like that. She's kind of, she still cares about her kid's safety, and she's not really, she doesn't seem like she's wildly out of control or anything. She just...
I don't know. There are times throughout the film where she seems almost childlike. She gets, you know, she starts giggling and bouncing up and down and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get it, yeah.
You know, something like, I literally have never thought of this before, but you saying that like brings it up to me. Like, what would Roy's reaction or behavior, what would it have been if one of his kids had, you know, done what Barry did and, you know, gone on to the ship? Because like, he's clearly like, I think that would have changed it. I don't know how it would have changed, but I think it definitely would have changed the way he approached.
Honestly, his reaction to me would have been more accurate. Like, it would have been much more like, oh, we're on his side if it was his kid that was abducted.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and I'll be honest, I didn't love the abduction of Barry, but that's just because I have a personal issue with kind of kids in danger, and it was a little bit too like, ooh. I mean, I didn't expect that it was going to be horror, but you still don't know what's happening when it's actually occurring, and I was like, I don't like this. Would at least take his mom with him. Yeah.
To me, it's also a product of its time as well.
Yeah,
like with that, and that's why I'm watching it, while it still holds up really well for a lot of things. There's things that just wouldn't fly being contemporary compared to then. And I'm not talking about use of cell phones or shit like that. I'm talking about just in general how people would react to things and stuff. I think it would be
different. No, I don't mean because they're very much latchkey kids. I mean, even Roy and his wife tell the kids, oh, just go out and play and go away somewhere. And I'm like, you don't know where they are. You know, this is pre-cell phone and stuff. But then again, people did that. As you said, it's probably part of their childhood, you know?
I did. I grew up. We'd go out and play.
Exactly, yeah.
When my dad's, I wasn't even allowed in the house unless I had to use the bathroom. And even then, as a small boy, they were like, unless it's number two, like, you need to be outside until dinner. Go play.
So I wonder how you feel then, Mike, knowing that, like, I know that this shot that I'm now using as my avatar, Spielberg considers it basically emblematic of his whole entire career.
Yes, I had that note as well.
We got we have an ESP going. I feel like we have are we gonna start making Devil's Tower out of mashed potatoes together or something like that?
Yeah. No, I had that exact note because it was Spielberg was asked to sum up his career in one master image and said it's the image of Barry at the door because the door is so big and the light is so all consuming and he's so small and it's kind of evocative of all the possibilities and this great sense of, I guess, wonder and you know, perhaps even being scary. I don't know. He didn't say that, but, you know, being a little bit nervous. But yeah, I can see what he means. That's a gorgeous shot. And it is, It's been copied everywhere. I'll be honest, it wasn't one of the shots I was familiar with from the movie, and I even saw like Stranger Things rip it off and didn't realize that's where it was from. But now that I do, I'm like, oh, okay.
I see. That's also where you and I, because I still remember the first time I knew about this shot going into the movie, and I thought the movie was going to start with this. I was like, oh, is it going to be like this kid gets abducted by aliens and like everyone tries to figure out what happened and why and all that. So imagine my surprise when I find out it's like at the halfway point.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Oh, fair enough. Well, I just have a few things that I wanted to finish off with regards to the writing, just my notes and some things that I found. First of all, obviously the film evokes typical sci-fi archetypes and motifs, but unlike a lot of films of the era, and again, I like this, it portrays new technologies as natural and expected, and human development is kind of healthy, and it's growth. It's not like the machines are going to destroy us. It's used. And to that end, it's kind of it's communication as highlighting kind of tolerance and I believe it was Spielberg, or again, I don't know exactly who said this, but somebody was quoted as saying, if we talk to extraterrestrials in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, why not with the Reds in the Cold War? And I like that, again, the solution to talking is music, and it is hand signals, and it's all these things that, it's a level of tolerance that I think, perhaps because of the times we live in, I was kind of even more touched by and was like, oh, we actually tried. It wasn't just like, speak English or we shoot you, you know? Which, you know, you do worry at this day and age.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I just love the whole logic to it, that it's like, obviously, like, if we're being realistic, like, let's say aliens were to land tomorrow, there's a negligible chance that they are going to speak any language that we speak on this planet. But as they say, music is a universal language. Tones and notes and pitches, those are things that are persistent throughout the universe. So it's very believable.
And it makes for a very... it makes for a very romantic sequence because, like I said, the five tones and the way that they work. I mean, we will get to the music eventually, but I just think it's such a gorgeous idea, and it's just so much more beautiful and elegant than anything else, really, when the ship's landing at the tower. So, yeah. The other thing I have, and again, sorry if you're groaning at this, but it is necessary. I do think that the film, and again, I'm not the only one that said this, has a lot of Judeo-Christian analogies, shall we say, where Devil's Tower parallels Mount Sinai, the aliens as kind of representatives of God, and Roy as Moses. To that end, Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments is actually on TV at the Neary House. That's the scene where the kids say, oh, Dad said we could watch this film, and Terry Garr says, but it's 4 hours long. And he says, what is it? His funny line is, well, I told them they could watch Five Commandments. So it makes that link for you. Some people have found close relations between Elijah and Roy, the biblical character of Elijah, because Elijah was taken into a chariot of fire, which people have compared to Roy boarding the UFO. Climbing the tower behind the faltering Gillian, Roy tells her to keep moving and not look back, a contrast to Lot's wife in the Bible, who looked back at Sodom and turned into a pillar of salt. And this wasn't in any of the notes, but I did notice it myself in the dialogue when I was watching, when they're kind of coming up with an excuse to get rid of everyone around the tower. They specifically say clear 300 square miles of every living Christian soul. So I think there are definitely religious allegories in here. Again, if you don't like it, fair enough, I understand. It's not all pervading, but I don't think you can necessarily deny it. And was it something that you guys kind of saw in this? Or...
I'll be honest, that's surprised. Like I didn't. That's not something I ever picked up on any of my watching. But now that you point out, like, I can't unsee it. Especially since I'm surprised, considering. I mean, yeah, any of those Judeo-Christian, you know, like, I mean, especially given Spielberg's Jewish upbringing, which I know obviously Moses and all that is from the, you know, of course. But still, like, because, you know, with few exceptions, like, I don't know, but I appreciate that. It's a nice little food for thought.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily the intended, like, biggest theme in the movie, but it's definitely there. And I think it also perhaps relates to tying into, like I said, that kind of childlike wonder and that magic. But, you know, there is a line where that blurs with religion, I think, in places without wanting to get offensive. And, yeah, kind of that's the stories we grow up hearing. And those are the first times that we do believe in the unbelievable, perhaps, if we've been raised in a religious household. So, yeah. Anyway, any other thoughts from you guys on that?
Not really.
No, I never really made that connection, but it is there when you look at it, and I appreciate bringing that up, mate.
Yeah, no worries. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll move us to the acting, because I have, again, tiny bits of information on this, and then we can talk a bit about it, because there's only really a handful of actors that have sizable role in this. So first of all, obviously the film stars Richard Dreyfuss as Roy Neary. Apparently, Steve McQueen was Spielberg's first choice, and although he was impressed with the script, he said that he wasn't right for the role as he couldn't cry on cue. Great. James Caan, Dustin Hoffman, Al Pacino, and Gene Hackman also turned down the part. Robert De Niro was also considered. Jack Nicholson declined because of scheduling conflicts. And this is the thing that really interested me. Spielberg explained that when filming Jaws, Dreyfuss talked me into casting him. He listened to about 155 days worth of Close Encounters. He even contributed ideas. And Dreyfuss himself reflected, I launched myself into a campaign to get the part. I would walk by Steve's office and say stuff like, Al Pacino has no sense of humor, or Jack Nicholson is too crazy. And I eventually convinced him to cast me. I really appreciate doing that. That's awesome.
You got a campaign for yourself.
I personally can only see Richard Dreyfuss in it, so like I mean yeah, sure he yeah. pressed his thumb heavily on the scale, but I'm not complaining with the result.
No, I think he's great in the movie. He was exactly right. I don't know if anybody else would be. Somebody like Jack Nicholson or whatever would just bring too much of their own star kind of overpowering star quality or whatever to it that you wouldn't fully believe as an everyman. So yeah, I buy it. I think he was great. Additionally, the film also has Francois Truffaut, as I mentioned, as Claude Lacombe, a French government scientist in charge of UFO-related activities in the US. The UFO expert Jacques Vallée served as the real-life model. I did not know that. And apparently Gérard Depardieu, Philippe Noiret, Jean-Louis Trintignant, and Lino Ventura were considered for the role. No idea. I know Depardieu, that's about it. Internationally renowned as a film director, this is Truffaut's only acting role in a film that he didn't direct, and it's his only role in an English language film. And again, I think he's brilliant in this movie.
He's great.
Yeah. And Terry Garr obviously plays Ronnie Neary, Roy's wife, and Melinda Dillon plays Gillian Gwyler, the name I've been struggling for. Apparently, Terry Garr wanted to portray Gillian, but she was cast as Ronnie. So, don't always get what you want, I suppose. And like we said, Bob Balaban plays David Lachlan, Lacombe's assistant and interpreter. And Carrie Guffey plays Barry Gwyler, Gillian's son. Apparently Spielberg conducted a series of method acting techniques to help Guffey because he was cast when he was just 3 years old. So, yeah. I hope it wasn't really awkward method acting type stuff because I'm not a huge fan of that personally. But like I said, I think it means things like showing him toys off screen to get the reaction of like, happiness, joy, and wonder, so that it's a bit more natural. And it worked. So, yeah. Any thoughts from you guys about the acting in specific that I haven't mentioned or you wanted to bring up?
I think Dreyfuss is really good in the part. That initial abduction, regardless of what you think, you know, it happens later once he becomes obsessed. His reactions in that scene are just fantastic. Even, you know, sliding into the comical when the flashlight comes back on.
Yeah, and he jumps.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I love that. I just wasn't expecting that to be anything. And when the truck behind him kind of goes upwards, I was like, is he on one of those, like, you know, like things you get in a garage where the car's on, like, the thing where so you can lift it up and work on it? And I'm like, oh, no, it's actually being abducted. And then, as you say, the light just pervading in the carriage and Roy just freaking out completely as to what's going on. And yeah, and I mean, I liked him until, like I said, he just went too far with it. But the opening scenes, when it's understandable, when he's kind of seeing what's happening and he first sees the UFOs in the street, and then even, you know, as he starts to play with the shaving cream and even the mashed potatoes and stuff to try and make this tower that he's seen, I was like, all right, I can get on board with this. But I said, I think he just went slightly too far for me, but I think that's probably me nitpicking a little bit. Yeah. What about the ladies involved? I think I know that Melinda Dillon didn't, for me, have a lot to do, but I think she's really good as Julia, especially considering she has the thankless role of just being the worried mum for most of the movie. But again, like you said, DK, there's kind of a childlike innocence and wonder as well that I thought worked really well. And Terry Garr, as I say, I feel sad for her because she did get lumped with the nagging wife cliche, and there's not really much you can add to that or do with that, but I'm still on her side.
I think I think both women performers in this are just really, really good, and they play against time because you know, you mentioned Terry Garr, and a lot of the time people do see her as this kind of, you know, playing the ditzy blonde that, you know, that she went on to be typecast as Phoebe's mom in Friends, and I won't say she's a nagging wife. You know, she's put into a situation where she doesn't want to know. And to the point where she, you know, she's literally at one point saying, I'm not listening, because she just doesn't want to deal with this shit. As you say, she's got three kids. She doesn't want to deal with what she determines to be a fourth. So
exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, is she a bit over the top sometimes? Is she a bit, I'm not going to say controlling, but that when Roy says, I'm going to head back out, and she's like, no, you're not. And he says, I am. And
yeah.
She's like, no, you're not. And I like it, but there's like an undercurrent there of maybe there's been problems before. And I think that's a good interplay between both Dreyfus and Gar. I think they, you know, and then later on where she's tolerating what's going on, and they're at that kind of MUFON little conference where the government's saying, you know, what you heard and what you saw is not what you heard and what you saw. And she's kind of tolerating it for a bit. And then, you know, the guy says, yeah, I once saw Bigfoot. And then you can see on her face, she's just completely tuned out.
Yeah,
that when seems you delivered that line, I was just like, you're not helping.
And you kind of want something to happen, and then you have the government taking the picture. The flying saucer, it was thrown over my neighbor's fence. It's here, it's made out of bone china. And I was like, oh,
yeah.
Really, just at that point, I could have slapped that guy. Like, we need to be serious here for a second. And as you say, when that clearly kind of crazy guy was like, I've seen Bigfoot, I was like, oh, good God, this is where we're going.
Which is I've heard those stories both before and since of like someone's like it's a UFO and someone's like no like a car tire like flew off in an accident or something like that so something never changed.
Even the more logical journalists are like well just admit that it's you're doing kind of experimental aircraft tests and it's like it would be easy to say that but I'm not going to lie to you. I'm like just lie.
You're lying about other stuff. Just lie about that part to make it easier.
Exactly, like,
yeah. Yeah. Anyway, just go all in.
Yeah, this film is not good when it comes to kind of trusting your government, considering the whole fake gas leak or whatever it is that they kind of try to use to evacuate the town. And although I don't know that I'd have been brave enough to do what Roy did and just like, I'm just gonna rip my mask off and see if I die.
Well, I'll look at it this way. He just knew, and it was the aliens telling him that it wasn't. So that's why you got to look at it that way.
True. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think with a lesser writer and director, this could easily have fallen into the whole like government covering up conspiracy, like don't trust the government cliche tropes and traps. But obviously Spielberg is a league of his own, so he makes it work.
Yes, exactly. And it ends up being, you know, a positive when you have the actual contact at the bottom of the tower there. So
yeah.
Well, I'm going to move us to the direction then, because I don't want to take too much time on this, but again, I have just a little bit of information, hopefully that'll interest you to read, and then we can ask your opinions on some things if we haven't already covered it. So first of all, Spielberg didn't want to do any location shooting because of his negative experience on Jaws, and he wanted to shoot Close Encounters entirely on sound stages, but thankfully he eventually dropped the idea. Very technical and budgetary problems occurred during filming. Spielberg called the production twice as bad and twice as expensive as Jaws.
Oh, God. Yikes.
Cinematographer Vilmos Zsigmond, sorry, I've butchered that probably, said during shooting, Spielberg got more ideas by watching films every night, which in turn extended the production schedule because he was continually adding new scenes. Zsigmond previously turned down the chance to work on Jaws, I should say. In her 1991 book, You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again, producer Julia Phillips wrote highly profane remarks about Spielberg, Zsigmond, and Truffaut because she was fired during post-production due to a cocaine addiction.
You have a problem with me, you do cocaine, and that's the only way to fix it. Like, if he did that, yeah, sure, blame him.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Spielberg wanted to shoot on location in Squaresville.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wanted to just drop cocaine all over the tower. What was it?
Crafty always had macaroni and cheese and cocaine. It just was a bad set.
Yeah.
Hollywood, man. But yeah, Spielberg... no film he's ever made since has been as hard to edit as the last 25 minutes of Close Encounters, and that he and editor Michael Kahn went through thousands of feet of film to find the right shots for the end sequence. When Kahn and Spielberg completed the first cut of the film, Spielberg wasn't satisfied because, in his words, there wasn't enough wowness, and he commissioned pickups. So I have to say it works, because those scenes are fantastic, and that's what being a perfectionist, I think, paid off, frankly, to be honest. So, I mean, there's lots of things that I've made kind of random notes on, little bits and pieces, but I don't want to, again, step on anybody's toes, so I'll throw it open and say, is there any part of the direction or any specific thing that you liked about this that we haven't talked about? Obviously, we've talked kind of thematically and about the writing that feeds into it. Is there anything else that stands out? And DK, I'll ask you first, because you've been quiet.
I just love the switch, you know, between awe and terror. And I think Spielberg does it really well in this film. And, you know, he does it in others, you know, like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark and things like that. But this, I'm genuinely unnerved most of the way through this. And considering how many times I've seen it, there's a certain magic about this film. And I think anyone else other than Spielberg wouldn't have pulled it off.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. What about you, Michael? Anything that you can think of?
I mean, I'm in complete agreement. We've covered a lot of stuff, and Spielberg is, as DK just said, the master of voluntaire, and I'll even throw another one like Jurassic Park, and like he just does it so well that it's, I mean, it is his style. Like we said, I mean, Spielberg has his own style with everything, and it works tremendously well, and this is what we get. We get a fantastic movie and get to have podcasts about it.
Exactly. And discuss it. And coming to you then, Justin, anything that stands out to you about the direction?
Yeah, I will say two things. For one thing, I know this won the Oscar for Best Cinematography, and it's well-earned for me because for my money, there's not a single questionable shot in the whole movie. Every single shot is just like, is poetry in motion. And Yeah, and special Santa, apart from the obvious ones we've already discussed, I love the shots of the little scout ships flying when they're, like, on, like, the highway over the hills, because it's just, on the mountains, because it's just brief enough that someone could say, oh, you were just hallucinating or you mistook it, but it's detailed enough that you're like, there's no way you can simply dismiss it and, you know, as an accident or people jumping to conclusions. Again, it's that perfect, again, like, everything else Spielberg does, just towing that line between, like, you know, again, with like a lot of alien, like UFO sightings where it's like, you definitely saw something, so you can't say, you know, but like, it's like, it captures it. Like I wouldn't change a single frame of this movie.
Yeah, I agree actually. And again, I like that's kind of when they ask Roy what he's doing there, his response is, I just want to prove that it's real, that it's really happening. You're not being gaslighted into like, no, it was just lights in the sky, or you were just tired or whatever, and you actually want that experience. It was that kind of hit me somewhere, I think. I just have, like I said, a handful of small things that I would mention. First of all, I love that Spielberg shoots for the cinema screen. Like, it's very much 16:9 and everything looks cinematic and wide, and you know, he's not bunched up trying to fit a TV or worried about how it's going to look when you pan and scan it or whatever. I love that the kind of the starscapes behind the house just look, again, that little kind of unsettling. Like, it's almost soundstagey, but it's just, it has that fairy tale quality that we keep talking about, and a sense of kind of awe, intensity, scope. You know, it's even when the ships and stuff are flying by or the trucks rising, it's always the scope of the thing feels like, oh wow, this is intense. You know, you're not watching a film, you're living it really. And I noticed again, he does these kind of crash zooms that are very nearly the same as the famous one from Jaws, when the ships are kind of flying around and he's focusing on various different people. And I was like, oh, I see you learned a trick there, Spielberg. And the only other note I've made is that as much as I love the kind of, as he said, the scene of Barry opening the door, I think it's a stroke of genius when he actually opens that scene by having the light just shining through the keyhole and hitting the kind of dust in the air. And the way that kind of hits is just like, oh, that's the kind of stuff you can't plan for or you can't overthink. It's just magic that, amazing, just looks brilliant to watch, you know.
And being on sets, I mean, they could have planned for it, but it could have been like when they first threw the lights on there, the keyhole was like, oh crap, look at what this does, let's shoot this.
Yes, exactly.
That happens all the time on film sets, so like it's we have an idea for stuff like, oh, we're gonna put the lights on here and stuff, and you get somewhere and then holy shit, look at this, oh, we gotta shoot this and change stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, he might have written in a script like, oh, the light shines through the keyhole, but the particular way that it does and the way it hits the dust and the way it kind of slopes and everything, you can't necessarily know what you're going to get with that. So again, it's just a little bit of magic, but there's so much of that in the film, I don't want to go on and on about it.
Love the use of matte paintings in this. I think they're done really well. For like example, when the UFOs finally go up, and the lights start coming back on in the city below. And I love when the when they're watching the UFOs and they kind of split up and they head up into the clouds. Those famous fish tank ink clouds. And I think I think it just looks beautiful.
Yeah. Definitely, definitely. I agree. I love the way the ships and everything look, but we'll get to that because that's our next section. Did you have something to say quickly, Michael, before we jump to
that?
Just
one last thing. The only thing I'll disagree with Justin on for, like, I wouldn't change a single scene is everything's beautiful, but I would take out the scene with him kissing Jillian.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not a shooting thing. It's just a choice that I don't think should. It wasn't needed. So.
Yeah, no, I won't dispute that. I'm speaking actually mostly from just, again, a cinematography, like the way it's shot.
Yeah. And again, it's like you said, everything's kind of a work of art. There's so many things. When you have shots that you're like, I would love this as a painting, time and time again, like any of the things we have, not accounting Whaley's kind of collage, but the three things that we have as our profile pictures, all of them would make an excellent painting just to hang in your room, you know what I mean? So that's a sign of great cinematography. And again, you can see why it won awards. But kind of feeding into that, as I said, we'll move to the next bit, the VFX and the production design. And once again, I've split the workload here. So DK, I think you have the start of this for us.
I do, yeah. Douglas Trumbull served as the visual effects supervisor while Carlo Rambaldi designed the extraterrestrials. Trumbull joked that the visual effects budget of $3.3 million could have been used to produce an additional movie. His work helped lead to advances in motion control photography. The mothership was designed by Ralph McQuarrie and built by Greg Jane. The look of the ship was inspired by an oil refinery Spielberg saw at night in India. And instead of the metallic hardware look of Star Wars, the emphasis was on luminescence of the UFOs. One of the UFO models was an oxygen mask with lights attached to it, used because of its irregular shape. And finally, a test reel using CG imagery was created for the UFOs, but Spielberg found it would be too expensive and ineffective because CGI was obviously in its infancy in the mid-70s.
Awesome. And just a little bit more then. As a subtle in-joke, Dennis Muren, who had just finished working on Star Wars, put a small R2-D2 model onto the underside of the mothership, which apparently you can see in the movie. If you go and look up, Google search it, you can find it, and you can see some close-ups of the actual model with it on. He also put a pea-sized TIE fighter at the end of one of the structures extending from the mothership, which apparently is less easy to see. Model makers also included a hidden mailbox, great white shark, Volkswagen bus, and a small graveyard. Clearly, Beetlejuice was involved in some way. The model also included alien figures moving in the windows of the miniature, though they were not very visible in the final film. The mothership model is on permanent display, just steps away from the Space Shuttle Orbiter Discovery in the Smithsonian Institution's Air and Space Museum, which I love. I love that. I'd love to go see that. The small extraterrestrials in the final scenes were played by 50 local six-year-old girls in Mobile, Alabama, I presume it's pronounced, the American way. That decision was requested by Spielberg because, quote, girls move more gracefully than boys. Okay, sexist. Puppetry was attempted for the extraterrestrials, but the idea failed. However, Rambaldi successfully used puppetry to depict two of the extraterrestrials, starting with a marionette for the tall extraterrestrial that is the first emerging from the mothership in what was apparently originally a test shot, and an articulated puppet for the extraterrestrial that communicates via hand signals near the end of the film. So, yeah, anything there stand out or anything you guys want to mention about the VFX that you think it works or the production design?
I mean, I thought it still, for a movie from 1977, looked amazing. Like, the effects-wise, I was like, these still hold up tremendously well for a movie that is this old. You know, it's, I don't know, it's just still crazy to think how good the effects were for this.
Yeah, I always prefer model work to CGI personally anyway. Yeah. I just think it gives it more life. You know, CGI can enhance things and everything, but just when you have a fully CGI ship, it's not quite as alive to me as a model. And this looks so good, the ships. And you were saying, Justin?
Yeah, I was going to say, for one thing, I agree, and same. And for one thing, it does and yet does not surprise me how many familiar names, like specifically Doug Trumbull and Ralph McQuarrie, that are names, obviously, anybody who's who's in the trenches of sci-fi, you know, film history knows, like, you know. Yeah. I was like, you know, I mean, sometimes, you know, like, there's a reason why they're damn good at what they do.
Yeah. I will say I recognize the name Carlo Rambaldi as one of the people who designed E.T. as well.
So, oh, yeah, yeah. Which, that's another thing, is that it doesn't surprise me that I know Spielberg and George Lucas love to, like, go back and forth and referencing each other's work in their movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like Yoda and E.T., for example.
Yeah, like yeah, Yoda and like E.T. is in the Galactic Senate and the Phantom Menace.
Yeah,
but also in Raiders of the Lost Ark, there's a little like C-3PO and R2 in the hieroglyphs in the Well of Souls.
Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, you know, Club Obi-Wan in Temple of Doom.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, yeah, that's cool. Well, because this film is heavily involved in music and sound, I've given DK that kind of task, shall we say, because you're kind of the music guy, DK, so you have all the information about that that I could find and anything you've added yourself. So do you want to go ahead and, you know, jump into that for us?
Yeah, John Williams included the, it's obvious to anybody that knows anything about films, he included the ominous two-note phrase of the Jaws theme among the music.
Yeah, I noticed that straight away.
Yeah.
Yeah, as soon as that happened, as soon as it went do, I was like, oh, Jaws.
That's subtle.
Yeah. He wrote more than 300 examples of the iconic five-tone motif to be used by scientists to communicate with the visiting spaceship as a mathematical language, before Spielberg chose the one incorporated into the film's signature theme, and then later used in Moonraker. Williams decided on five notes because it has to be somewhere between a fragment, which is four notes, and a song, which is seven notes. So he decided mathematically it would be five notes. Now, Spielberg initially included Cliff Edwards' original When You Wish Upon a Star from Pinocchio in the closing credits, but after a Dallas preview where several members of the audience audibly snickered at the inclusion, I mean, come on, it's Dallas. You know, the song was dropped and replaced with Williams' orchestral version. Phrases from When You Wish Upon a Star are included in the final sequence in the director's cut, and in the special edition of the end titles on the 1998 collector's edition of the soundtrack. And Williams was nominated for two Academy Awards in 78, one for his score on Star Wars and one for his score on Close Encounters. He obviously won for Star Wars, though he later won two Grammy Awards in 79 for his Close Encounters score. So,
yeah. Well deserved. I love this kind of score for this, especially, like I said, the way that the musical motifs are used and the kind of the hypnotic kind of nature of the five tones, I think is just gorgeous. But I've said all that already. So again, did you have anything you wanted to add, DK, to any of that?
I love where it gets to the point where the keyboard player can no longer keep up and they switch to the computer and they're just talking between themselves. I freaking love that scene. It's a highlight for me.
Oh, wow, okay. Well, we'll get to that. We'll ask you highlight later. So, yeah. And how about you, Michael? Anything that you kind of, that brings to you about the music?
I mean, it's iconic. Spielberg uses the same people for reasons.
Yes.
A lot of things. And it's like, you find the best, then we'll continue to work together. And it's just, there's like that sound, even when I heard it when I was like 7 or 8 years old, when I first saw this in the 80s, I still in my head today, even before watching it, rewatching it this morning, like I still know it, like that's how iconic it is. And there's really not much to say other than it's great.
And I mean, as DK said, it's so well known that they use it as a joke in Moonraker. It's the kind of the tones that the door code makes as Roger Moore's typing it in, you know.
I will say for people of a certain age, they grew up on soundtracks reinterpreted by Jeff Love and his orchestra.
Oh.
And I grew up with a disco version of the Close Encounters thing. And honest to God,
I want
to
hear that.
You have to look that shit up. Jeff Love.
I've got it.
Close Encounters. Yeah, it's... You'll never go back.
Yeah.
You probably
it already kind of has a disco quality to it with the way that it's kind of synth.
Yeah, so just wait until you hear that.
But I have to say, like, I would be remiss if I... Like, some of my best, happiest childhood memories are every summer we would go to Tanglewood, which is in Western Massachusetts, and John Williams himself would put on a film night concert, and that was honestly probably my biggest familiarity with Close Encounters before I saw the movie proper, was putting on so he would put on like, and sometimes some standouts for me is, you know, he did Close Encounters, he did Indiana Jones, he did you know, E.T. and Harry Potter and Memoirs of a Geisha and all that, and so that was that more than anything to me stuck out. I'm not sure if you know, but John Williams recently had a documentary about him or a special on Disney Plus. Yeah, I'm not sure if anybody's seen that. And I just thought that was very insightful.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, still my personal favorite anecdote was when they were working on Schindler's List, and John Williams says to Spielberg, you need a better composer than I am for this film, and Spielberg replies, I know, but they're all dead.
Yeah,
because it's like no one better than John Williams, because five tones for me, I would go so far as to say is that those five tones capture all of humanity. They have our curiosity, our excitement, our fear, our some of our aggressiveness, but also our trepidation. It's like I feel like somehow in those five notes, like only John Williams can, just so much of humanity in like a single sound is put into there.
Yeah, it gives me chills, and as you said, for just five notes, five tones to have that effect, it's I mean, obviously he trial and errored it with 300 different versions, but yeah, it's just really good, and it's John Williams. You didn't mention his best score, by the way, which is Superman, but I'll forgive you.
Obviously Superman's. I love Superman is great. I mean, I think anybody who that's great too.
Yeah, fair enough. Awesome. Well, I'll tell you, I'll move to the next section then, because we've kind of talked, I think, to death about what we love about the film and why. But when I do cinema classics, I never really ask the audience's response, because it's assumed that it would be a given that they're going to like it. It's a classic film. And I'm always more interested in the critics' response, which I have written out here again, this is what I do every time we do the cinema classics. So again, hopefully this will interest you, but this is what I have for this. So Jonathan Rosenbaum refers to the film as the best expression of Spielberg's benign, dreamy-eyed vision. A.D. Murphy of Variety magazine gave a positive review, but wrote that Close Encounters lacks the warmth and humanity of George Lucas's Star Wars. Murphy found most of the film slow-paced, but praised the climax. Don't really see what you're talking about there, but okay. On sneak previews, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert highly recommended the film. Siskel praised the message of not being afraid of the unknown, said Dreyfuss was perfectly cast, and described the ending as a wonderful scene combining fantasy, adventure, and mystery. However, he mentioned that the story got bogged down by a subplot in the middle. I don't know what he's referring to there specifically, but there we go. Ebert said the last 30 minutes are among the most marvelous things I've ever seen on the screen, and that the film was like a kid's picture in its innocence. Jean Renoir compared Spielberg's storytelling to Jules Verne and George Méliès. Very high praise. Ray Bradbury declared this the greatest science fiction film ever made. Wow. David Thompson wrote that Close Encounters had a flawless wonder, such that it might be the first film ever made, calling it a tribute to the richness of human imagination and as close to a mystical experience as a major film has come. But it's the mysticism of common sense. The movie could have been naive and sentimental. It was inspired by Disney, but Spielberg never relinquishes his practicality and his eye for everyday detail. Pauline Kael wrote of the film's climax, there is a conversational duet, the music of the spheres. This is one of the peerless moments in movie history, spiritually reassuring, magical, and funny at the same time. Very few movies have ever hit upon this combination of fantasy and amusement. The Wizard of Oz, perhaps in a plainer down-home way. Many prominent directors have cited Close Encounters as one of their favorites, among them Stanley Kubrick, Edgar Wright, Bong Joon-ho, Spike Lee, Denis Villeneuve, Guillermo del Toro, Christopher Nolan, Greta Gerwig, and Andrew Stanton. Close Encounters has been highly placed on numerous polls of greatest films, greatest sci-fi films, and greatest film moments. It was a critical and financial success, eventually grossing over $300 million worldwide. It received numerous awards and nominations at the 50th Academy Awards, 32nd British Academy Film Awards, 35th Golden Globe Awards, and the 5th Saturn Awards, and has been widely acclaimed by the American Film Institute. And finally, get your drinks ready, cinema classics fans, because in December 2007, it was deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant by the United States Library of Congress and selected for preservation in the National Film Registry, just like all but one film that we've covered so far on cinema classics. Please, American Film Registry, just give Daleks Invasion Earth just a place in there, just to give us 100%.
Yeah, I think you're barking up the wrong tree there, mate.
I think I probably am, yeah, but never mind. So, with that done, then we just we come to kind of the end part. We're just going to give our favourite things, our conclusions, and our score. So I start on my episodes always by asking your favourite character, moment, and line. Michael, I'll ask you first for all three, if you don't mind, your favourite character, favourite moment or scene, and your favourite line, if one springs to mind.
All right, my favourite character is actually Barry. Mm-hmm. He's not in it a ton, but I don't know, to me that's a young Spielberg kind of just like what he would do in that situation and how he would be, and And what was the I had the line and now I can't think of it. It was something he said near the end.
Oh. Bye?
Not the bye. It was
Oh, when he says like, oh, I went up and I saw our house or something. And
yeah, it was that whole little thing there. It was just I just really enjoyed that. Like he was just his eyes were with wonder. He wasn't scared. And I think that's a good statement on this entire thing. It's like there's no reason to be scared. Like, yes, in our eyes he was abducted, but that's not necessarily what the aliens were doing. So like in my head. So I don't know. That was my I really liked Barry as this, because none of the other characters we were supposed to like necessarily, like we've all said, like, well, I think Richard Dreyfuss did a fantastic job. I didn't really like Roy as much. Mm. Like, I mean, he wasn't every man, but I mean, he made some bad decisions, and we know psychologically why, but still.
Yeah.
And what was the other thing? Was my rating on this, or?
Not a favorite moment or scene, and we'll get to the rest later.
A favorite moment? Even the, just, I mean, from an outside perspective and not like sympathizing with the characters. I mean, when he's going crazy and the neighborhood's watching him and stuff, that was fun to me. Like just
okay.
In general.
Fair enough. No problem. That's great. So Justin, we'll move to you and ask your favorite character moment or scene and line if one speaks out to you.
Yeah. I mean, I gotta say, I think my favorite character is also Barry. Cause honestly think the movie actually just, it wouldn't be the same without him, because like, without him, that movie doesn't have as much of that same sense of innocence and curiosity and wonder that, you know, like, he really just, I think he sells it, like, it wouldn't hit as home as hard if it was just all the adult characters, for one thing.
Yeah.
And,
fair enough.
Yeah, and I think my favorite line is definitely the ordinary people and extraordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, because that is just so emblematic, again, of both the movie, the themes, and Spielberg's whole career and ethos as a filmmaker. So I think it's just, it perfectly summarizes all of that. And I would say my favorite moment is definitely that, you know, those last 20 minutes, just that whole back and forth with, you know, the government and the aliens. Because even though we don't know exactly what they're saying to each other, but we don't need to. I actually think it would be lesser, at least to me, if there was like subtitles or something.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like those things that, like that silent understanding that, you know, that we kind of know what each side is saying to the other. And also, like, again, that just innocent curiosity from the aliens as well, like this whole peaceful like, I think it's just all like chefs, because it's all just the perfect bow to tie this whole experience together.
Definitely. Although I will say there's one particular scene when they're talking to the puppet and it's doing the kind of sign language thing where the puppet's got its hand up and it almost looks like it's kind of like at a rock concert. Are you ready to rock, Cleveland?
See, that just tells me the aliens have done their research.
By the way, my line actually was, I went up in the air, I saw our house, is what I was trying to think of.
Yes. Yeah. No,
that was just, I really liked that line.
And I think she responds like, did you see me running after you.
Yeah, it's such a pure and also believable, realistic exchange. In
yeah, exactly. Like that. And that's what that line sat with me after while I was rewatched.
I believe it. Yeah, that's cool. And yeah, I'm kind of with you as well. Just in ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances is very a kind of mission statement, I think, as well, of Spielberg and of the movie. So yeah, DK, you know the score. I don't need to tell you what we're looking for here.
Yeah, I've already told you my favorite scene. It's the back and forth between the aliens and the keyboard player, is just, as you know, Justin said, I just think it's phenomenal. It's when everything starts to come together. And I genuinely, I mean, there's a scene in that where Gillian looks around at the board that's flashing and the music's playing. And that's when she starts jumping up and down and giggling. And I have that same kind of emotion when that scene is on. It's just beautiful. It's joyful. As for favorite character, I'm going to go with Lacombe. I think Truffaut, to say that he'd never acted in a Western movie before this, is absolutely fantastic. I love that he's got that little arc from investigator and kind of, you know, sort of government stooge to the point where, you know, he's actively egging Barry on. He, you know, he wants there to be some kind of higher meaning in the end. And that little scene in where he and Roy meet and they're sat opposite sides of the desk and he says, you know, go outside and make me a liar. It's where those two kind of subplots intertwine and it's sort of a light bulb moment between the two guys. And I love that. So yeah, Lacombe for me. And as for line, I'm going to go with something right from the very start, which kind of sets up the whole premise for me, and it's really intriguing. It's where they're translating that old guy, and he says the sun, you know, he says the sun came out last night. He says it sang to him, and I just love that.
I meant to mention that when you were talking about the opening of the scene. I was going to say that's such a poetic kind of very early kind of thing to hook you into the film. I was like, I love that line. It's just so well written. It's so much with so little, and it's so good. I didn't have it as my favorite line, but yes, I can see why you would say that. Cool. Well, my favorite character was also Lacombe, actually, weirdly enough. I think, like I said, I would have liked to see more of him, but I find him likable and relatable in his desire to explore and discover without having Roy's overwhelming obsessiveness. He's also kind and moral. And what sold me was the line where I think it's Lachlan says they were invited, and Lacombe just responds, "They have more right to be here than we do." I was like, wow, that's such the opposite of all the government people that are just like, no, keep them back. We've got to. I was like, that says the kind of man he is, and I kind of love that. Favorite, so many. I don't think you can beat the ending, but I knew somebody else would say that, and it seems a bit basic bitch. That would very much be my number one choice, though I love the entire last kind of 20 minutes or so. But since somebody else said it, and it's very basic, for a second choice, I will go with the opening scene in the truck with the first encounter, because I just thought that was incredibly done. And very well acted by Dreyfuss, and the special effects kind of coming into play as well, and everything just all comes together really well. My favorite line is from the support leader looking at the returnees. They haven't even aged. Einstein was right. And then the team leader's response, Einstein was probably one of them. I love that. That's just my kind of funny, weird sort of on the nose humor. So yeah, then all that's left for us now to do is give our conclusions, any that we have, and our score out of 5 stars. So, Michael Whaley, I'll come to you first, if you don't mind, and ask for any conclusions you have and your score.
As Spielberg's going to Spielberg, and this is, you know, that's really all I have to say about it. It's a great movie. I'm going to do 4.5 stars.
Okay. Is there any particular thing you can point to that keeps it from hitting the exact 5? I'm not putting you on top of
them. Small little nitpicky things that I like, different things with different character choices and a few things like that, some of which we've already brought up about and stuff. And that's, I think that's what's gonna, like, I think, like, if it was just rating, like, if there was like 7 or 8 different things that I was rating it and on the scale, there would have been like just a couple little small things that were 4s or 4.5s. And so that's what brought it down to me to not a perfect 5.
Fair enough. Justin, what about you?
Yeah, honestly, I'm going to go 4.5 as well, because, okay. I mean, I've said, like, I feel like, you know, throughout this conversation, I've said everything I can there's to say about this movie, and we've, I think, more or less agreed on, like, what the few chinks in this film's armor are, you know, which I think are pretty, and given that even Spielberg had, like, retroactively said, I would have changed that, and you know, I think that, you know, that just shows that his natural, it's just a man who was made, born to make movies. And so, but I think given that this is early in his career and that this is as outstanding as it is, I mean, I think, you know, that's why it just, you know, like that 4 out of 5. Yeah, 4.5 out of 5. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's what I've written. Fair enough. DK, over to you then.
For me, I mean, Close Encounters, it's from that era of Spielberg movies that are, you know, in my opinion, nigh on flawless. It's often said that a good film is not something that reaches you just visually, but it touches something inside. And no matter how many times I've seen this, and, you know, believe me, it's a lot, it never fails to elicit emotion from me, whether it's awe, terror, or a combination of the two. Visually, this is a work of art, with the effects and lighting being on-screen alchemy. Williams' score is, as you'd expect, iconic. Dreyfus, Dylan, Truffaut, Balaban, and Gar all play their parts to perfection, and the story carries you along while keeping you guessing. The later cuts in the director's version do improve upon it somewhat, tightening things up a little and making it more punchy. But honestly, and I realize this is probably very much a rose-tinted spectacles issue, as I saw it as a at a formative age, this is one of the few movies I consider almost perfect. And because of that, it's going to be 5 from me.
Okay, awesome. I had a feeling. So, so my conclusion similarly is quite thought out in film magazine style. There we go. I think part of me kept putting this one off and didn't watch it, weird as it sounds, because it felt so much in my wheelhouse that I worried it might let me down. Again, it's one of very few Spielberg films I haven't seen, and it's kind of been on my shelf for a long time on Blu-ray. Luckily, it didn't let me down, even with all of the expectations I had going in. I just love Spielberg's direction, and so many of the things I admire about him are right here on display. Those sweeping shots, the big cinematic scope, the way he stages everything, and how the effects and imagery often look, as we said, like they can be framed as art. And it's not just pretty pictures, it all feeds into a story that hits me in exactly the ways I respond to, not just because it's science fiction, but because of the sense of wonder, the mystery of the unknown, the joy of exploration, and that warmth of connection and communication. The final act is every bit as beautiful as I'd heard, and I really wish I'd had the chance to see it on the big screen. Hopefully someday. It's not just a long march to that ending, though. For me, it could maybe have been a little tighter, and I'd have liked more time with Lacombe, but overall, the pacing and structure are pretty much spot on. The way it sets up ideas and then pays them off is brilliant, and that music, just gorgeous, as we've all said. I do have some issues, though. I just found Roy really unlikable as a protagonist by the end. He treats his wife terribly, then kisses another woman because she gets him, and I agree with Spielberg that he shouldn't have gone on that ship and abandoned his kids. And while it works out in the end, I also didn't enjoy Barry's abduction. I just don't like seeing kids in that kind of danger, and it was a bit too unsettling for me. But overall, I couldn't wait to talk about this one. I'll definitely rewatch it, and I'd absolutely jump at the chance to catch it in a theater. With time, I can definitely see the magic outweighing the gripes. But for now, after one watch, it's a very strong 4.5 out of 5 for me as well. So, pretty much universal scoring, I think, with the exception of DK, who understandably went a little higher. I can definitely see myself reaching to a 5 at some point if I watch this enough, and I will. But, so in the meantime, putting those together, dividing by the 4 of us here, gives a final score for Close Encounters of the Third Kind of 4.6 out of 5, which is pretty bloody good, I would say. So you can't be too mad at that, DK, I assume.
No, I was expecting lower, to be honest. That's why I was kind of on the edge of my seat when you were watching it, thinking, yeah, he's not going to like this. But I'm glad you did, to be honest.
It's the kind of stuff that I totally love. And like I said, I think that's why I was putting it off. I was like, oh, it's disappointing. Especially after we had that thing where I went to see E.T. when they brought the 3D version out. And was like, oh, this isn't as good as I remember. I wasn't bad, but I was just like, I don't quite get this kind of masterpiece, greatest thing ever. It's fine. It's good. Mind you, when I saw Jaws in 3D, it had the exact opposite effect, and it was the first time I was like, yes, I can see why this is excellent. So It depends on my mood. But yeah, this is entirely my kind of shit. And I will say, as much as I give it 4.5 and not 5, it is, I think, number 4 when I put it together of my Spielberg films that I've seen. So I remember watching. I know Jurassic Park and Schindler's List are 1 and 2. I forget what number 3 is. But yeah, I think it might be Last Crusade, actually. And then this sneaks into number 4. Anyway, so as Barry waves us goodbye and our podcast mothership takes off to the stars, it just remains for me to thank today's guests. So thank you, Michael Whaley, first of all, for joining us again.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see you again on an episode. I think we've got you. I know you've got you down for Planes, Trains because you watched it a few months early.
Then the next one is Eve of the Daleks is the next one for this year, the last two that I have for this year for you guys.
Oh, okay, cool, fair enough. And so did you have anything you wanted to plug or anywhere people can find you online?
Always Michael Whaley on TikTok, on Instagram, and I'm getting ready to start my photography business up, which doesn't necessarily help people overseas, anybody in the U.S. that follows the podcast, I'll once I get everything up and running on there, I'll shoot you guys a link to throw into the bio awesome. On here. So I'm gonna start doing more of my photography business, as you know, need money to survive in the hellscape we're in currently. So always good to have extra.
Awesome.
But other than that, I've got nothing else really coming up right now. But if anything changes, I will let you guys know.
Awesome. And yeah, what about you then, Justin? Is there, well, first of all, thank you for joining us on your first silver screen. And I hope we'll see you again after this because it's been really good. And did you have anywhere you wanted to plug or anything that coming up that you can let people know about?
I've had fun. Definitely. I'd say look out. Like, I can't say anything official, but just look out for me. Watch out for me. And Justin Avery Smith on all the meta sites, because that's like the one piece of generosity Zuckerberg has ever shown, but is to let me use my full name. But but just a very Smith on like TikTok,
for sure.
Yeah. And Justin Avery Smith on Blue Sky. But apart from that, yeah, that's all awesome. I got. Yeah.
I'll always have those in the episode descriptions along with where you can find us and everything. So, yeah, DK, thanks for coming back and thanks for sharing your passion for this movie. I've genuinely enjoyed talking about it with you as well.
Yeah, it's good to be back, and what an episode to come back on, mate. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Hopefully, even if you've seen the movies we're doing on Classics, it's nice to revisit them. So it seems like you had fun.
Definitely.
Awesome. Is there anything you want to plug anywhere people can find you, or are we just still in hiding?
I'm still kind of in hiding, although someone close to me suggested I set up a new social media account, which I have done, but I'm not going to give it away just yet.
Okay, fair enough. Cool. Intriguing. You and Justin have both left us with tantalizing hints. So there we go. So, yeah. And thank you as well if you've made it through this cinematic trip with us. If you liked it, please, again, like, share, subscribe, spread the word, ideally more efficiently than using musical tones or hand signals. We'll be back in just 1 week with a new episode of Silver Screen Regular Flavor, where we're breaking down a modern-ish Western with guests Adrienne and Nita, and ain't that a daisy. Until then, stay curious, enjoy some movie magic, and keep watching the skies.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Cinema Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Cinema Classics is hosted, produced, researched, scripted, and edited by Michael Wilson. Additional material by DK. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Links to all of these places can be found via the link tree in each episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production created by Mike Wilson. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Join us again next time, and hopefully this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Here's looking at you, kid. Cut!